Shank Baggily. Shank Baggily. Shank Baggily. Hello and welcome to Shatbaggily, an old Lincolnshire adjective to describe absolutely anything loose and disorderly, which sums up this Lincolnshire lass quite nicely. My name is Katie Johnson, and in a moment we'll be joined by the first of my guests, the recently crowned UK's Burger Chef of the Year, before chatting pesto, pistou, vinegars and kimchi. First though, because we're on Series 2, Episode 7, here are a few things with the same number. The name by which the secret ingredient of Coca-Cola is known by is 7X. Turns out the people who know the recipe, they never travel together. Oh, a bit like the royal family. The percentage of methane present each time we pass wind. And recorded accidents in the home in the UK in 1997, and I honestly don't know any more than this, involving putty. So I hope you've had a good week. I'm slowly getting used to not being able to bite down quite as hard since I've had Botox in my jaw, the one that stops your teeth grinding. But you'd have been very proud of me. Oh, yes. I managed a couple of Toblerone. You know, the really big one. The one you get on holiday. And it was in the fridge. That was perhaps a bit more sucking than normal, but I did it. Once again, Glyn and I have been working at a food festival. This time, Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. There we met up with a lovely Murph from the Beefy Boys. Murph is one of the founders of the phenomenon that is this independent burger chain, which began as a group of friends who enjoyed a barbecue and now run 3 restaurants and a truck. It was good to see him again, especially as he'd recently been crowned UK's Burger Chef of the Year. But how does it feel?
Yeah, surreal. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, because obviously we've been doing this for a long time, and then to get a reward like that, yeah, it's really validating. It's really nice. Yeah, yeah. Really nice.
But you don't get a sash or...
No, we don't get a sack. Or a crown, really. A crown's what I'm after. I'd be a proper Burger King, then.
Because then wouldn't you say that, isn't it, they used to do in the work Miss World, want to travel the world and help work with children?
Yeah, world peace.
That's
world
it.
Peace through burgers. That's what I'm trying to do, yeah.
Now, 70% of the listeners to this podcast are from America.
Oh, really?
And we've got the UK Burger Chef of the Year. How do we compare with American burgers?
Well, I mean, I've been over to America a few times. I do think that, obviously, they do, it's the home of the burger, and they do burgers really, really well. There's a lot of really bad burgers in America, but there is a lot of really good ones. A lot of really high-end restaurants doing really, really interesting stuff with burgers. Some of, like, the burger chains over there are amazing as well. Because, obviously, over here, we've got Five Guys, you've got McDonald's, you've got Burger King. Over there, there's a whole world of brilliant ones, like In-N-Out Burger, etc., that are doing amazing things. Shake Shack, have obviously started coming over here a bit. So... I mean, that's the thing about burgers. You get everything from, like, your $2, $3 burger to your $30, $40 burger over there. So, but I think Britain's doing really well. I think Britain's coming out. The burger scene here has got amazing in the last 10 years. It used to be so hard to get a good burger in Britain, but now there's, you know, almost every city has a great burger, a local burger restaurant there. So I think we're catching up, I think.
Well, you went over there when you first started, Beefy Boys, and you came second, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. Second in the world. We were blown away. We really did not expect it. We really didn't expect it. But I think the reason we did well, I think a lot of people over there were in that specific competition were really trying to overcomplicate it. And we've always been, just do it simple, do it well, and, you know, let the ingredients speak for themselves. Because that's the thing, as long as you've got great meat, and, you know, really good quality bun and some tasty sauces and some nice cheese, it's going to be an amazing burger. And I think sometimes people do try and overcomplicate them, especially these days, because I think people are trying to one-up each other all the time. So, yeah, go simple, I think, is always the thing.
And the secret with yours is it's the best quality meat, isn't it? It's not only just a Hereford breed, but it's the cut.
Yeah, so we use chuck and brisket. Our butchers are fantastic. They've been with us since day one, and they help work with us and everything from the grind, which is, you know, how big the meat goes through the mincer, to the cuts, to how long it's hung for, where the meat comes from, what it eats. There's not many places to hide on a burger, so you've got to make sure that the meat is amazing. That's your first step. If you've got amazing meat, It's very hard to make a bad burger. Do you know what I mean? Unless you really overcook it or you burn it or something. So as long as your ingredients are fantastic, then it'll be, you know, a bit like Italian cooking. That's what the whole Italian cooking's based on, isn't it? It's amazing ingredients, just treating them really, really simply. You know, same with a burger.
Now, next year, we said it's about 10 years since you were over there. You're going to go back to the States, aren't you?
Pretty sure, because we always did quite well then. If we spoke to them, they would probably let us back in on the 10-year anniversary. So you get to do your signature burger, which we would do, and then you get two other burgers where they dictate a bit more to you. So they might give you an ingredient. So the one year where we did the best, where we came second, it was honey was the ingredient. So we made like a honey barbecue sauce. Like on other years, they'll give you like a theme. So the one year it was like a Hawaiian themed burger. So we did like a little like a Hawaiian sort of grilled pineapple, like a teriyaki sauce. And we put some spam in there because spam is big in Hawaii. And so yeah, you get to do three burgers. One's your signature, and then two that you might have, like, you know, a bit like MasterChef or something like that. You have to think about it and be creative.
Okay. Is there a burger out there that you haven't done yet that you've always wanted to do?
Oh yeah. Burgers that I've made at home but haven't done in a restaurant, I would love to do. One's a Juicy Lucy, so that's where you stuff your burger. So you stuff your patty with cheese. But, like, you got to be careful because they do have a tendency to explode. And they're a bit of a nightmare to do. I'd love to do that at the restaurant. I'd love to do a patty melt, which is a bit like a hybrid between a cheeseburger and a grilled cheese sandwich. That would be a great one for us to put on the menu. So there's so many. You really wouldn't think there's as many types of burgers out there, but it literally it's in the thousands, do you know what I mean, the different types that are out there.
Crazy. So when you go over to America then, you mean business. You're going to come home with it number one, aren't you?
Oh, we'd love to. We've come so close. We've won rounds. I mean, we've won the signature burger round twice over there. We've come so close to winning, but we've never taken the title. So we've won the one in the UK, but the world one, we've always just seconds as close as we got. So yeah, if we went, obviously, we'd love to win it, obviously.
When is it?
Oh God, I think it's November 2024, if we were going to do it. We've got to have some conversations with our wives and our partners to be like, because they just think we go over and, like, you know, get drunk for 10 days, which there's a bit of that, do you know what I mean? So yeah, as long as our wives and our families, like, okay, yeah. But they're really supportive of everything we do anyway, so should be all right.
Gosh, 10 years next year, not sure where that's gone. And it's been fantastic to witness the success of the Beefy Boys. Thanks to Murph, and here's to many more accolades along the way. Staying with Tewkesbury, our friend Steve Lyons, the chef who trained under Raymond Blanc, OBE, he was there doing a demo, which included pesto, which somehow he managed to get down the front of his shirt, just as I was about to ask him a question on something else that he mentioned.
I can't believe that. Flicked it all over myself.
Mm, yeah. Well, there we are. It'll taste nice later. So, I've learnt something this weekend. There's pesto, which we all know, but there's pisto as well.
Pistu.
Oh.
Pistu.
I thought first you were taking the...
Pistou.
Okay. What's that?
So, if you ask a Frenchman, they'll say they came up with this first. If you ask an Italian, pesto came out first. So pistu is basil, olive oil, garlic, salt. That's it. Add your pine nuts and your cheese, and then you get pesto.
It's just that, just the cheese. That,
yeah,
and
one's French, one's Italian. And they argue about who came up with it first.
Which one do you prefer? And would you have them in different different uses?
Pistu, I like. So you can get what they call pistu soup, which is a really fantastic summer soup, and it's all the vegetables, and you just stir through right at the very end the pistu, which the French version, and it that tastes really, really nice. That's how I like that. But if I'm going to do it with pasta or fish or something like that, I prefer pesto.
So you did a squid dish today, which we don't really eat. Well, this country we don't eat enough fish. Yet we should. We're an island.
Yeah. But trying to get good fresh fish is really hard, as you say, even though we live on an island.
Squid, hot and fast or slow and low?
I prefer it hot and fast. But yes, that's true. Same with octopus.
Yes. I was going to say, what about the fish? But then you beat me to it there with the octopus. So if we're going to do it, it's the all the gubbins though, Steve. If you've got a fishmonger, get them to do all the...
Oh, definitely. You'll be able to buy it prepared. Definitely, most of the fishmongers will sell it prepared. Trying to find it whole sometimes can be a bit hard, but definitely find just squid tubes is all you need to do it.
Right. Wasn't that a Netflix series?
That's Squid Games, but yeah. It's the next one, Squid Tubes.
Or it could also work as the name of a band, Steve. Thanks ever so to Steve Lyons from All About the Food in Worcestershire. Thank you also for your lovely messages this week after I asked a question regarding the new format on social media. Glad to hear enjoying it. But Cindy and Maggie did say they are missing the antique cookbook talk. And when you think about it, that's how it all began, really. So to rectify that, I have found one. I have delved through the Whatsits and found basic recipes by Margaret Shepherd. I think it's Fidler. Or is it Fidler? F-I-D-L-E-R. It's from the 1950s. I tell you what, she's got an impressive CV. She was a cookery editor. She's a triple honours diploma in domestic science. And you'll love this. I quote, an examiner in cookery for matriculation and other bodies. I did think I was looking at Sherlock Holmes for a minute. She gives some wonderful advice, including when guests come to dinner. So it's got it here. When you have guests to dinner, make simple menus with dishes you know will be a success. Okay. And then she goes on to say those that you should choose and avoid those which require sauces and dressings to be made at the last moment. She says, let the courses vary in colour and general character, e.g. have one hot, another one cold. Have one soft, another one crisp, etc. One in individual dishes, another served from large dishes. One of blended browns and greens. I don't think she means in a liquidiser. Another yellow and cream, or with red predominating. And all I could think of was she'd gone a little too close with the mandolin. Anyway, she goes on to say, picture the meal in your eyes and in your mouth as you plan it, and let it be pleasing on the plate and the palate. So there we are. Thank you, Margaret. Yes, I will certainly continue to do the old antique cookbooks because that's where it all began with Isabella Beaton, bless her, and saying you boil pasta for 1 hour, 45 minutes. Back to our guests. And another chef with a great pedigree is Steve Guy, former head chef in Jamie Oliver's cookery schools in London. Steve loves his vinegars. And it was the mention of his pineapple one that intrigued me.
It's a journey I started on a couple of years ago when I was looking around food waste and what you can do with bits and bobs you've got left over, scraps, peelings and stuff like that. And so pineapple vinegar seemed to be the most successful and easy one to start with. I think it's got the most amount of yeast on the outside of the fruit, so therefore makes it easier to turn into the vinegar. And I was blown away by the response to it, the flavour, how easy it was, how simple it was. And quite a comforting output in terms of personally when you've made it. It's quite a nice craft to get into.
So we've had the pineapple as we'd always have, I don't know, chunks, rings, all that. We've prepared it as we would. But it's all the bits, so it's the skin. Would it be the top as well, with not the leaf bits, but it's just the body of it?
Yeah, so really any part of the pineapple, you can do it with if your actual whole pineapple's on the turn and the flesh is going a bit too soft for you. But yeah, all those outside bits, not the spiky bits on the top of the leaves, they can go in the waste, and it's just those into a jar covered with water and a couple of spoons of sugar. So the sugar's there to feed the natural yeast, which is what will turn it into alcohol, and then with an interaction with the oxygen, that alcohol then turns into acetic acid, which is the vinegar that you taste.
So when you say a couple of teaspoons of sugar, is there a ratio or is it just by eye? What would you say?
Yeah, I'm an instinctive cook who doesn't like to go with weights and measures too much. But generally in about I think it's about a litre sized kilner jar, I normally put 3 to 4 dessert spoons of sugar.
So not huge.
No. All the sugar's there to do is to speed up the process. If you just put the fruit in with the water, it would eventually still turn into alcohol and vinegar. It would just take a lot longer because the yeast will take that time to ferment and get going.
I see. So if you did use the fruit, if it was on the turn, you would still put sugar in there?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, it's interesting that I think probably the most delicious vinegar I've made is a brown banana vinegar.
No.
Yeah. So when they've gone completely brown, you know, the kind of stuff you make banana bread out of. Just peel them, doesn't need the peels, just the flesh, just in water. You don't need sugar for that because it's already got so much yeast and alcohol in it that just covered in water, leave it for a week and you have the most incredible banana vinegar.
What? I'm reeling from that because we do have some bananas in the bowl that I am thinking about banana bread.
So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to do this. So we just put the chop them or just put them in, because they're quite mushy, aren't they?
Yeah, chuck them in whole if you want to, or you can kind of smash them up a bit and drop them in. It doesn't really make a huge amount of difference.
Just cover them in water, no sugar.
No sugar, yeah.
Leave them. And then what am I going to do with banana vinegar?
Pretty much anything you do with any other vinegar, to be honest with you. And this is kind of the excitement of this journey, is because all of a sudden, even as a chef, I've been very much in the past going, oh, what's the point in all these different types of vinegars you can buy? You know, apple cider, your sherry vinegar, your white wine vinegar. They kind of do the same thing. But then when you start to get really different flavours in there, you start to assign them to little things and little points of difference. So like banana vinegar, I love to put in some desserts because it's got that banana-iness to it. So again, with pineapple, it goes really, really nicely because you think about pineapple and banana and those sorts of flavours together. But you can use it just as you would any vinegar, any dressings, anything that you want that sourness to.
Is there something that you would not do with the vinegar? Because you even said about using the tops of strawberries. The little you can use, the little grassy bits then.
Yeah.
So is there something that you wouldn't?
There's nothing I wouldn't try. Absolutely not. There's nothing I've come across yet that I've gone, oh no, that doesn't work. I've made chili vinegars. Like I say, I've made all sorts of different fruit peelings, different types. And it also means, because you're in control of that process, it means that you can ferment them as long as you want to. So you can take the sourness to where you like it. So if you'd like your vinegars not quite so acidic, you can leave it a little bit back and have it as a little bit more of a sweeter kind of finish.
I'm going to try that.
Absolutely. Honestly, you'll never turn back. Your cupboard will be full of killing jars.
I didn't like to tell him. I'd just given three of those away. Thank you to Steve Guy, a.k.a. The Hungry Guy, based in Shropshire. Hello to Japan and Nigeria. I had a look and new countries tuning in. And thank you to the Netherlands, to Canada, Australia and here in the UK as we are once again back in the charts. Staying with our worldwide friends, let's turn our attention to Korea and the wonderful world of fermentation. Dahae West is a Korean cook, teacher and author of Eat Korean, who we've worked with several times over the years, and in fact only last October when she joined us on stage at RHS Wisley's Taste of Autumn event.
When I was working with you, I'd noticed that my vision was slightly off, and then that weekend I ended up going to A&E and I've been in and out of hospital since then. So this is the first time I'm doing anything work-related. So you're the last thing I did work-related, first thing I'm doing work-related, because I've just been in and out of hospital the last 6 months. We're all good now.
What was it?
I had a brain tumour on my pituitary gland.
Oh my.
So I've had two surgeries and quite a long stay in hospital and stuff. So I haven't been working. I've just had everything's just been on hold. But I'm back to normal now, as normal as it can be, given all the circumstances.
Good grief. So how long do they think that had been in there?
I think that I'd always had it, but it had slowly been growing until it was pushing on my optic nerve and like distorting my vision. As soon as I had my first surgery, I was able to see again.
Jeez. So, and they've got it all out, have they, Dahae?
Yeah, so I've just finished 6 weeks of radiotherapy. So that is hopefully getting rid of all the last sort of remaining bits.
Oh.
And so I'm just waiting for a scan now.
Oh, well, fingers crossed and everything's sorted. Flipping out, you don't do things by halves, do you?
Yeah, it's been quite a lot this last 6 months, but we're going to have a really good summer to make up for it.
So the distorted vision then, what were you seeing that made you obviously think this isn't right?
Well, at first I thought my glasses were just like a bit smudgy and that I couldn't see properly. I was noticing I was losing my periphery vision. So it was almost as if you, like a horse has got the blinkers on, kind of like that. So, and then it was almost where I'd lost almost all my sight in my left eye.
Oh.
And so when I was with you at Wisley, I was squinting a little bit and noticing I couldn't really see very well. And so that's why I ended up going to the hospital that weekend.
So you'd been living with that probably a bit too long by the sounds. You should have gone a bit earlier.
Yeah, it's just, it's one of those things which I think is not like really, it's not often picked up because also the kind of tumour I had is particularly rare. They only see a few cases of it a year. Even in the UK, there's maybe only 4 or 5 cases. So it's not something that a GP can easily detect, where I'd had like some symptoms before. It would never been like picked up on.
Well, that's it now.
Just
that's it.
You've put a dampener at the beginning of the conversation. But all is good now.
I can't believe, so the last time you worked was with me, and now the first sort of thing you're doing work-wise is with me.
Yes, it's like coming full circle.
Oh, gosh. Well, anyway, big hugs and hope you continue with that. You look really well, I have to say.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I feel back to normal now. It's taken like a little while to kind of feel back to normal.
I bet. And scary as well. Scary, because it's one thing thinking your sight might be on the way out, but then when you're told that it's due to a tumour, that's...
Yeah,
you weren't on your own when you received that news, I hope.
Well, so I was on my own, but my mum and dad came back from Korea, and Gareth has obviously been really good, and we've had amazing support from our friends and family. We've been really lucky. Unfortunately, you know, we live in Sandhurst now, so all our friends and family are much closer than when we were in Milton Keynes. So it was really nice, actually, that everyone's able to like rally round and offer that support.
It's weird how things work out, isn't it? You'd only really recently moved down there. So have mum and dad gone home now? Are they still with you?
They are still in England. They normally stay for the summer and then they go back for the winter months. They'll go back in sort of September time and then spend the winter in Korea.
Yeah, I bet they won't want to go home.
They have been sort of invaluable being around. I don't know what we would have done without them, to be honest. I kept saying, you don't need to come back, you don't need to come back. But actually, I'm very glad that they did come back.
Yeah. Oh, so for those that don't know you like I do, because home was originally in Korea, wasn't it? Which part was home?
So I'm from Busan, mm-hmm. Which is on the south coast. So the particular area I'm from is called Namhae, which translates as sort of South Sea. Which is quite funny, really, because my parents live in Portsmouth now in South Sea.
Oh.
So it's kind of like quite funny how it's worked out that way. Busan is an incredible city. It's the second city in Korea. It is just very lively. I always feel like it has much more character than Seoul, which is very cosmopolitan and very modern, very trendy. But Busan still has a lot of that sort of, it feels more like an authentic career, like one that I think of as home, really.
Yeah. And you came over here when you were very little. Was it 3 or something? You were very young.
Yeah, when I was 3. I was very lucky. My mum was always very insistent that I keep in touch with my Korean roots. So we used to go to Korea very often. I used to spend like all my summers out there, say sort of 6 weeks at a time during rainy season. The weather's not ideal. I wouldn't recommend necessarily visiting Korea during the summer holidays because it's either very, very hot or very, very rainy.
Mm.
But I used to have such a good time and I've just got so many like just good memories of being in Korea. It's always felt like a second home to me.
Mm. But you've stuck with heritage because it's what you do, Korean food. You teach people how to cook Korean food.
Yeah.
You wrote a book. You worked on several television programs all about Korean food. Was it the Korean Embassy? Was it in London? You did work with them as well. So you do have that such strong link.
Yeah, sort of when I was young, though I've always enjoyed the food and enjoyed going to Korea, I sort of rebelled in terms of being Korean. I never spoke Korean to my mum up until I was about 18, even though I'd always understood because she'd always spoken to me in Korean. But I'd never sort of embraced my Korean heritage until much later. And it was only sort of once I got married and Gareth, you know, is English, and taking him to Korea sort of made me see Korea from like a different perspective and see it kind of through his eyes because he had never been to anywhere in Asia and he was just completely blown away by how amazing Korea is. And I think that gave me a whole new appreciation for Korea and the food and just actually made me reconnect in a lot of ways. So kind of thanks to him really that we started the street food business. We had Busan Barbecue, which was our Korean street food business, and it was off the back of that that all these other things, teaching and the TV shows and stuff, came about.
And the book I did mention, it had a name change somewhere along the line.
Yeah, so it started off as K-Food, and then it got renamed as Eat Korean because it got republished as a paperback copy. So they thought that Eat Korean would be a bit of a more obvious name and it gave it a bit of a kind of jazz it up a little bit. So yeah, it started off K-Food is like a bright red cover and then Eat Korean has like a picture of a Korean dish called Japchae. on the front, which is, I think, looks quite inviting because it's very colourful.
Yeah, and you've always done it as Koreans, but we are only really slowly now getting into it, but it's very on trend, is fermentation. But you're doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, very much so. I think because traditionally Korean winters are very, very cold, and so it was an essential way of preserving vegetables. There was no other way of sort of getting that nutrient, so it was really important as part of Korean cuisine. Koreans are very hot on health and making sure that they're getting all their nutrients. So preserving sort of the best vegetables throughout the winter when they couldn't grow anything was really key. So it started off as just sort of salting vegetables, and that started centuries ago. And then slowly, I think it was in the 17th century, that's when chili actually got introduced to Korea. It was actually as late as then. And that's when kimchi became the thing we kind of know it as today, that sort of spicy fermented vegetable. People always think of it as cabbage, but it can really be anything. Mm. And so fermentation is not just kimchi, but there's a lot of different Korean banchan, which are side dishes, which are also fermented, as well as there's what's kind of known as like the three mother sauces, the jangs, which are soy sauce, which is ganjang, gochujang, which is the chili paste, and doenjang, which is the soybean paste. Those three ingredients are like the three backbones of Korean cuisine. So you have those in your cupboard and you can pretty much make anything.
Mm-hmm.
That, as well as kimchi, obviously. So fermentation is just Korean food. It's in everything that we eat.
When we've worked together in the past, you've mentioned kimchi and I've smelt it a little bit. It's you have to have a separate kimchi fridge. Or in Korea, they bury it in the ground. It's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, so traditionally, pre-kimchi fridges, it was buried in sort of earthenware pots and buried in the ground. And that helps the kimchi breathe, which is important for fermentation, but also it keeps it really cold, which is very key. So a kimchi fridge in Korea, you can buy them in the big stores, and they're generally a couple of degrees colder than a regular fridge, and they keep your kimchi really nice and fresh. And it also means that all the rest of your fridge doesn't smell like kimchi because obviously with ingredients such as garlic and spring onions, it's very pungent and it can make anything else also taste like kimchi, particularly if you've got any dairy products in the fridge. They always take on that sort of kimchi whiff if you've got them alongside each other.
Mmm, lovely. So if anyone's thinking about maybe having a go at kimchi, I know you have an easy one, but the traditional one is, I guess, the one that you would say to people, or would you say go with the easy one first?
I like to make the easy one when I'm kind of in a rush, but it doesn't last as long as making a traditional kimchi. So the easy one that you're talking about is the gochujang, which is like a kind of like a summer, almost like a salad one that I did at Wisley with you last time.
Mm.
But the more traditional type is called pogi kimchi, which means whole cabbage kimchi. And the reason why that one is particularly good is because it basically doesn't have any sort of shelf life. It really lasts forever in the fridge because it is fermented. Whereas the gochujang, because you're adding sugar, it sort of speeds up the lacto-fermentation. And so it doesn't actually last very long.
Right.
And it's something that you would eat quite soon. So it kind of depends on your kimchi needs. But I always like to have some of the whole cabbage kimchi sort of in my fridge because it's something that's really versatile. We use it not just as a banchan, a side dish, but also as sort of a really key ingredient in a lot of Korean dishes like soups, like kimchi jjigae, which is a Korean stew using very fermented kimchi, or in a kimchi fried rice or kimchi pancakes. There's just so many different things that you can use it for to add like a bit of spice and tang. And it's obviously something that's now known to be really, really good for you as well, full of really healthy bacteria. So something very handy to always have in.
So is it a case of a teaspoon every meal, a dessert spoon every meal? How much would you or a native of Korea have on a daily basis, Dai?
Definitely much more than a couple of tablespoons. I would say you would normally have at least one or two, sometimes three different types of kimchi on the table. There'd definitely be at least one. You'd eat it for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner. it might be an ingredient, like I mentioned, in a dish. If not, it's definitely something you would eat alongside every single dish. So it's something that you eat in quite big quantities. So we go through a lot of cabbages in particular.
Right. Okay, well, let's go with the traditional one then, if we may. Are you happy to share? Because I know every family would have their own kimchi recipe, wouldn't they? That family. Are you happy to share your family recipe?
I have a recipe, but I always sort of tweak it each time I make it. It depends on how big your cabbages are. It depends on what chili powder, the gochugaru, you're using. So there's obviously lots of sort of different ways that it might taste slightly different. Also, it depends on what I have in my fridge, and I will generally add like different things in depending on what I've got. But as a loose base, this is kind of what I would do. Mm-hmm. So if we're doing it a small portion for those people that are not eating kimchi with every meal, if you're using one cabbage, you would then split it in half. I would often then quarter it if it's quite a huge cabbage, like the kind you get at the Chinese supermarket. Mm-hmm. If it's just a smallish cabbage that you would get at a regular, like Sainsbury's or Tesco's, then I would probably just cut it in half because they're generally a bit smaller. And then I would have a dish of salt next to me. I like to use like a coarse sea salt because that really is something that like rubs really well into the individual cabbage leaves. And I'd have about 4 or 5 tablespoons of salt ready. And I would take a big pinch of salt and stuff it in between each cabbage leaf and rub it up and down the leaf so that it was really well coated. And you're doing that to sort of really season the cabbage, but also that's really important as part of the fermentation as well. And so it often looks like quite a lot of salt to start off with. But then later on, after sort of 2 hours, when the cabbage is really nice and soft and wilted, you rinse all that salt off and squeeze it out. And so it's really important to kind of salt it enough. So don't be scared of using too much salt, really. You're better to use a little bit more rather than a little bit less. If you don't use enough, then you can find that your kimchi goes moldy. So where people have had problems where their kimchi might not have lasted as long as they've hoped, it's perhaps because they haven't used enough salt in the first place. So once you've salted it, you've washed it, you've squeezed it dry, then I would make sort of a glue, a paste, which I would do with about 150ml of water, which I'll have brought to the boil, whisked in about a tablespoon or so of sweet rice flour, or sometimes it's called glutinous rice flour. And that makes like a gluey, really just a gluey sort of mixture. And once that's cool, you can add some the gochugaru, which is the chili, Korean chili flakes or chili powder. And it is quite important that you try and get hold of the Korean chili flakes because that's what kind of gives the kimchi its unique flavor. Because the Korean chili flakes are quite smoky and quite sweet, and they have quite a unique chili flavor. And then to your taste, you would add a couple of teaspoons of minced garlic, minced ginger. I like to add apple, just sliced in there because it gives it a little bit of sweetness. And also the natural sugars help with the fermentation process. In Korea, we often use Korean pear. So you can use regular pears as well and just slice them up. I like to add carrot for color, spring onions. You can also add muli, which is the daikon radish that's often traditionally used. That kind of helps bulk it up. Also, it takes away any of the saltiness. And then just add 2 to 3 tablespoons of fish sauce. And that gives it the sort of that unique kimchi flavor. And at the very beginning, when you taste the kimchi, it should taste a little bit too salty, a little bit too fishy. But that's because as it ferments, that kind of flavor matures and becomes tangy and a little bit sour. And so you kind of almost want to over-season it at the beginning so that it tastes really good after a couple of weeks. And then use like an airtight jar, or I like to use a kimchi box, which is like something with a clip-top lid. You pop the kimchi in there and leave it just on the side for a couple of days, and that helps start the fermentation process. And once it started fermenting, you just pop it in the fridge. And then that, though it keeps fermenting in the fridge, that slows down the fermentation process because the fridge is obviously cold. And then you've kind of got kimchi for as long as you want to eat it. It will slowly mature day by day. And you can really use it with everything. I like to have it with noodles. I like to have it with rice. But also things like kimchi cheese toasties are very popular. And yeah, we like kimchi mac and cheese. We have kimchi with all sorts of different things.
And when you've made it then, and you say this is the one that will keep forever and ever, how soon would you recommend to use that kimchi that you've made, Dahe?
I would say leave it in the fridge for probably about a week and a half to 2 weeks. And then it tastes best once it's a little bit matured. And then I normally use that kimchi up. If I was only making one cabbage, I would probably use it up within a couple of weeks. But you could really use it for the rest of the next few months or however long you really needed it for. Mm.
And the
so
salt.
That's what's great about kimchi. No, go ahead.
No. That's what you're saying. That's what's great about kimchi.
Yeah. So that's what's great about kimchi is that it's that time investment at the beginning. But it's not like you're stood there stirring a pot or anything like that. You are salting it, then you leave it, and then you come back to it. So almost like you would do with like making bread and having to wait for it to prove. And then you put it in the fridge and then you've got it for however long you want it for. So it's kind of like you're putting that time in at the beginning and then you've got something healthy and delicious ready to sort of spice up any dish that you've got coming. So it's definitely worth making.
And the salt, is it a sea salt, a rock salt, or a grant? What salt would you recommend, Dai?
So at Korean supermarkets, you can get particular salt for kimchi, which is like a Sola salt. And that is, they've got a very nice like grain to them. They're quite big and they melt very nicely into the kimchi. But otherwise, I use just like molten sea salt flakes or any sort of sea salt flakes. They have a good texture when you're rubbing it into the kimchi leaves. Mm. I would recommend that over sort of table salt or rock salt. The rock salt doesn't dissolve as well, so any sort of sea salt flake is good.
Right, and nothing that you do your drive with.
No.
Oh, bless you. Well, thank you for that. And what I'll do is I'll pop that on our Instagram and Facebook page as well, if that's all right.
Yeah.
And then links to your website and the book and what have you. So what next for you then, Dahe? You're obviously starting to do bits and pieces. Have you got anything in the diary or just taking it slowly?
Taking it slowly a little bit. Before all this craziness happened, I was actually... I'd taken a step away from the food side and I was actually helping someone with a personal project, someone that lives in Australia who had contacted me. Well, they wanted someone to write a memoir about their life. So I was actually doing that. They are a Korean sort of older lady who kind of wanted to chronicle her life for her child and her grandchildren, just to kind of see how she grew up, because she grew up in very unusual circumstances. And so that was a project that I was working on. So I will be continuing again. I really enjoy recipe writing and coming up with new Korean recipes and doing my classes again, because obviously that's all been on hold. So it'll be nice to start everything back up just like it was before.
Wishing Dahe a continued recovery, and thank you for joining me on that, Bagley, and indeed to all my guests. I will put their information on Facebook and Instagram and also the recipe for kimchi kindly mentioned by Dahe. And you can also get in touch via those or email podcast@theshatbagley.co.uk. And as I always say, if you feel an urge to leave a review, please don't fight it. So that's it for another week. Thank you for listening and see you next time. Right. Glyn, is there any Toblerone left?